Welcome to Conscious Bridge Radio, the program where we explore the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture. Now here is your host, the author of four books, including Be Yourself and Our Spiritual Evolution, Mark Gilbert.
Yes, thank you, and welcome to Conscious Bridge Radio. This is Mark Gilbert again, and we've got a really good program for you today. As it said in the intro, the Conscious Bridge Radio is about the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture. And today we tap into all three of those topics. We're going to be discussing an upcoming book to be released the first week of July. It's entitled Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All. And we're going to be discussing this book with its author, Stephen Dynan. Stephen's joining us, and he has, you may know him from the Shift Network. He is the founder and CEO of this program, which is a leading global provider of online transformative courses and trainings. I know that I am a frequent listener to his programs and have enjoyed the Shift Network for a number of years. Prior to that, he worked with the Institute of Noetic Sciences, the Esalen Institute. And he also has another book published previously entitled Radical Spirit, Spiritual Writings from the Voices of Tomorrow. But today we're talking about Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All. Welcome to Conscious Bridge Radio, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, you know, I just finished reading your book, and I really, really enjoyed it. You know, one of the things, though, that I was curious about and is what led you to feel the calling to write this book at this time?
Well, you know, I feel that it being in the whole conscious transformation movement, evolutionary movement, and doing all of this deep inner work, it's become very imperative to me that we make the shifts that are happening internally real in our society. So there's really no way for us to avoid at some point getting involved in the political conversation and really starting to shift the larger social frameworks, because ultimately for our own personal transformation to become real and enduring and lasting, we have to shift our society and make it more enlightened and reflect really the higher principles and consciousness. So I started off on a path of personal transformation through East-West psychology and yoga and meditation and all of the good stuff, transpersonal psychology. But in 2004, I got very turned on to bring that into the political realm through the candidacy of Denis Kucinich. He was probably the first political leader for me who was bridging these worlds and how he was speaking about them and really talking about a higher spiritual aspiration as the core of our political process. And so got very involved in that campaign. And ever since, I've been involved in different campaigns, but also starting to get involved in citizen lobbying with our Congress people and Senate and writing for the Huffington Post and always seeking to find a way to have more unitive philosophy and framework apply to our political process. And that's really the roots of this book. I see our America being torn apart on many levels by a level of partisan warfare that reflects a very dualistic and separative way to do politics. And it's really compromising our ability to fulfill our higher destiny as a country and really serve not only the people who are worst off, but even the people who are best off in America are not served by the highly combative, polarized discourse, because it's tearing families apart, it's tearing communities apart. And this is going to be a particularly dramatic year for that as well.
You know, I hear this from so many people, Stephen, and in fact, I have that feeling myself that we seem to be at a very crucial choice point within the both the United States and its political system, as well as the world at large. I know this was a theme of one of my books many years ago, feeling that choice point as well. But I'm seeing a lot of people out there right now who are feeling and saying the same thing. You know, this program is a part of the Coffee Party USA network, and most of the people who come and join the Coffee Party or get involved in its activities do so out of this same sort of sense that they want to make a difference. They recognize that we're going through this particular change in the planet, but they want to really step up and play a role in directing it to its highest possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things your book talked about, though, is the desire or the need to create something that it referenced as a sacred worldview. I'm curious what that means to you, to have a sacred worldview.
Hmm. Well, the reason I speak about that is because I really feel it's the ground out of which we can birth a new possibility for our country and really the larger world. And a sacred worldview is one in which we see the sacred in all things and all people, that we honor the divinity in each other, and we don't get as locked up in our polarized belief systems and separate sense of like my religion versus your religion or my country versus your country, that we're really seeing that we have this shared sacred ground of being that connects us. And it also connects us with nature. So when we live in a sacred worldview, we see the world in a different way. We see less separation and more opportunity for communion and for coming together. And so when we apply that to the level of a country, it's like we take very seriously the need to look at other political positions as also having a sacred depth to them, or a sacred, worthy of sacred respect, if you will. So this translates into one of the core concepts in the book around political cross-training, is that we are actually strengthened and enriched and grow from being able to step into and see the world from the eyes of another. So if we're busy just demonizing the other or fighting the other, trying to impose our worldview on somebody else, we're not going to be able to find what might be interesting, evolutionary, could be more creative about another position. When I was writing the book, I actually, I mainly have friends in the progressive side of the equation or kind of transpartisan, not as many like traditional conservatives, but mm-hmm. I had a few people who read the book who are consider themselves more conservative, and offered some pretty, both some positive feedback, but also some stronger critiques. And I really listened to them and took in their feedback and actually shifted how I was depicting certain aspects of a conservative worldview in a way that got them on board with being endorsers of the book. But I also feel like, more importantly, it evolved my understanding to be able to take the role of the other and enrich my understanding. And the reason this is so important is that the way I see it is that progressives and conservatives often represent two poles of how a society evolves. And so there's things that we want to progress. We want to go into new territory, new possibility, new rights, things that haven't historically existed. And there are things that we need to conserve, like the values and the principles and the institutions that have endured and worked. And sometimes people who are in the progressive camp can get so caught up with the change the world energy that they want to undermine the very roots and foundations of what has been successful in the past. And so then it can create a polarized tension with conservative forces, because they're the enemy that's holding us back. And then conservatives feel like it's just like this willy-nilly change and not respecting tradition. But rather, there's actually this kind of positive evolutionary tension, if we can hold it that way, between people who want to change things and innovate in a new direction and open up some new possibilities, and people who want to preserve the best of what we've inherited. Now, it's not completely black or white. It's not like, you know, the conservatives are all about just keeping things the same. But there's a way in which those core value systems and core orientation toward life end up being more complementary in terms of the growth of a healthy society. Just like with a human body, we have things that we're wanting to grow in our human body and new as we grow up. But there's a lot that we have to maintain homeostasis and preserve in order for all of our systems to not go completely out of whack and potentially even kill us. So society is sort of a delicate balance between stability and growth. And so oftentimes we polarize into these political positions without respecting that underneath they're actually both serving the larger whole.
Very, very well said. You know, one of the things that occurs to me too is that, you know, and I know you're a student of spiral dynamics, and Don mm-hmm. Beck was on the program a number of months ago. But spiral dynamics paints this picture where we move through these particular worldviews. And the way I like that model is I can look at someone who perhaps is in a conservative worldview, and I can say, there but for the grace of God or life circumstances, I would probably believe exactly like they do. And right. Somebody else is who may be in a, because I tend to label myself as a progressive as well. But my conservative friends have, you know, they have the very same sort of outlook that sometimes they want to say progressives are not right. Yet when they can hold that space of, well, if I had moved to the worldview that they have, that I might look at it that way. And I think one of the things we can see from that is that we all have both of these viewpoints sort of embedded in us, that they may lie dormant based on our life circumstances. And I think if we can look at it from that sort of standpoint, that maybe, but for the grace of God, I would have that same belief from either side of the spectrum. That opens you to seeing the divinity in the other person, which is really what you're talking about.
Right. And it's like everybody has their right to exist and their right to also choose what sort of rules and guidance they want to live by too. And so part of a democracy is built upon a sacred respect of the individual, and that we're preserving the rights of that individual and also giving the individual a right to have a say in the rules that govern them. Mm-hmm. So there's always some necessary tensions built into that, because you have very different worldviews, very different priorities, and very different values. So if we identify too much with the things that are separate about us and start to go to war with other aspects of other people within our society, that actually breaks down the trust and the mutual exchange that allows more evolution to occur. So part of my theory is part of what's going wrong in the United States is that we have a lot of very deep, insightful intuitions about where we're going, but we often don't respect the people that are holding it all together, holding the past together, if you will, and the value systems that have worked. And Don Beck likes to talk about the blue glue that sort of creates the social stability that is both healthy for the society, but allows young children to grow up with a sense of a more ordered value system. Sometimes we get into this kind of leading edge discourse and looking at, you know, experimental modalities. And I was thinking Burning Man, you know, Burning Man is just all about experiment and art and creativity and possibility, but that can be actually destabilizing for a growing child. And so we're looking at the importance of having this solid blue foundation to create a healthy society, and then we build further upon that. But if we diminish and attack and undermine and disrespect that, that's ultimately going to create backlash both in the people involved, but also in terms of creating a healthy, multi-leveled society. So we always want to, that's why we want to respect the role everybody plays in the whole system, and really make sure that people get the message that their needs, their desires, their priorities are respected, and that their voices need to be heard as we come up with solutions that are really optimizing our society for all of us.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And, you know, Stephen, I see you as one of many writers and teachers who are out there today. I probably would put myself in this group too, who feels like it's important to develop an evolutionary viewpoint, to sort of sit back and see how life and the world and the planet is really going through a process of evolution that's not simply material evolution, but cultural and spiritual evolution as well. And that was a theme that I saw coming, you know, loud and clear through your book. And I'm curious as to why you see this as so important, and how does one really, in your mind, start developing that sort of evolutionary lens of looking at the world?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of practices that take us into evolutionary terrain. I mean, meditation probably has the most scientific grounding and backing now, and just really demonstrating that we go through different stages and levels of development. And you know, the impulse is always towards to take care for greater wholes and to take into concern a greater number of people. So we're moving towards what I call a global consciousness, and other people frame differently, but we're moving towards really seeing ourselves and embracing ourselves as one planetary species, and also taking better stewardship of this planet. And so we have things pushing us towards this globalization, and also pulling us, from media to finance to the internet to global travel. There's all these things that are basically bringing us into a deeper relationship with the whole world than we've ever been capable of doing in historically. So we're really entering this global era, but it means that we have to do that on also on a structural level too. With like the United States, we're moving out of a nationalistic version, a nation-centered version of U.S. consciousness into a really a global-centered version. So in the nation-centered version, we're sort of free to do whatever we want to ensure the strength of the United States and then take advantage of other countries. And so you see the shadow side in books like John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman, or, you know, there's a lot of critiques of different wars and invasions that are basically very self-interested. So in that model, it's okay to be like a self-interested actor on the global stage. But when you start to open to this global consciousness, you realize that when we are acting in a way that undermines the health and well-being of other countries and other peoples, that creates a rupture in the fabric of culture and on the world, and that eventually comes in form of blowback. And so it will undermine trust in America. It will lead to disrespecting. It will lead to economic breakdowns, potentially even to wars, terrorism. Those things are often symptoms of breakdown in a more global kind of consciousness and care. So part of what my theory is, you have to kind of make these shifts gradually for the society. But as an example, like we invest a ton of money in military forms of creating security on the global stage. I make the advocacy, what if we redirected a small percentage of that to global microfinance? Microfinance goes to developing world entrepreneurs who are wanting to start a new sewing business or a new haircutting business, or, you know, different small businesses that just help feed a family and get people out of the cycle of poverty. And groups like Kiva.org have created enormous engine for tens of millions of people to do this work of bootstrapping out of poverty through microfinance. So if you do the same thing, instead of spending the money it takes on one bomber, to instead invest that in microfinance in, let's say, Islamic countries, that is likely to have a much better long-term effect than having the aggressive military posturing. It doesn't negate, there's some need for that in a fairly dangerous world with a lot of bad actors, that you need to have some of that kind of more masculine strength and that kind of muscular approach to. But if you don't have the nurturance on the other side, if you're not supporting the development of a country and a culture and a people, then they're going to tend to polarize against the more military dominant side, and that actually ends up being more expensive and less fruitful long term. So it's good to have both sides. It's sort of like a balance of masculine and feminine, to have the peace building, economic empowerment, the genuine support and aid and generosity that is helping peoples get on their feet. That's going to ultimately lead you to spend a lot less money on defense infrastructure in the long haul, because it's going to weave the human family together in a whole different way.
Yeah, you know, it all arcs back to that developing that sacred worldview. I think once you develop that, then you start to see that everything is connected and has value. And that, right. and then you want to uplift the collective and not necessarily be selfish and see life right. as, you know, you become more about cooperation and less about competition.
Yeah, because while our identity is bound up just in ourself, or in the case of a collective, our nation, then we're only really caring for that smaller unit. And but ultimately, that's going to undermine the highest potential, because when we can take care of everyone, which I say fulfilling our mission into service to all, if we can really bring everyone into the equation of, like, we want to create a thriving planet that works for all. Which is, I really see embedded in the founding DNA of America. E pluribus unum means out of many, one. And I don't think that was ever intended to just be a motto for unifying 13 colonies. It was about a mission of bringing us to greater wholes and greater oneness and greater unity, not just in America, but ultimately on a planetary scale. So I think as we express that mission in still higher levels, and then there's a natural synergy that emerges, a creative exchange, a mutual empowerment that happens versus a kind of a win-lose mentality, which is win-lose is very built into that more individualistic, nationalistic kind of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as one of my day jobs is a minister for Centers for Spiritual Living, and it's a global vision is creating a world that works for everyone, which is the phrase that you used right in there. And
yeah, so well, Centers, for, So I would say that Centers for Spiritual Living are a great example of a globalized perspective finding expression as a religion and a religious form. And so we're getting a reflection of another level of consciousness evolving in all sorts of domains. You have that in healthcare, moving from a more materialistic, aggressive kind of interventionist paradigm to more of a health empowering, holistic, healing kind of paradigm that includes Western medicine. So it's integrative medicine. So we've seen that in religion. But what we haven't really focused as much attention on, which is what I do in the book, is what does that look like in the political sphere? What does a holistic politics look like, where we're really taking into account the whole body, the whole political body, not just Democrats and Republicans? So it's more purple in that sense of people who, you know, are speaking to this deeper blending and unification of left-right polarities into a larger whole where all are seen and respected. We're really one United States of America.
Yeah. You know, it's been my perspective that a lot of people who may see themselves as on a spiritual path at a certain point recognize they have to be like that bodhisattva that comes back to the world and wants to uplift the planet for everyone. So the spiritual path will lead you to the world, and the world path tends to lead you to the spiritual world. And I think that's an interesting dynamic that I have noted. A lot of people would argue with me on that, especially people who don't see themselves as spiritual. And I get that, but it's been my experience that a lot of people that really get in one path and are really moving through it or get called into the other world at some level.
Yeah.
I want you to give you a little plug for your book, though. I want to come back and touch on some of the stuff that you've been referencing there, Stephen. But your book is called Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All. It comes out in July, right?
July 5th. And I chose that date specifically because July 4th is celebrating our independence and the founding and growth of our country. And July 5th is a good day to explore where do we go next? How do we evolve still further into global interdependence?
Ah, yes. Interdependence Day. Yes, absolutely. Now, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was the idea of the fact that we have to heal the shadow. You referenced that in one of the authors that you were talking about a moment ago. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I really like in your book is that it's call for America to take a look at healing its shadow. Michael Moore, I don't know if you've seen his most recent movie, but he did the same thing in there, was a call for the U.S. to take a look at healing our shadow as well, where we've caused harm in the past, mm-hmm. and you know, maybe make amends for it, or at least come to grips with some of the things that perhaps we want to bury or forget. Why do you see this as so important, and what are some of the things that you think we need to heal, and how can we go about it?
We'll give one example. I mean, just to begin with, it's when Columbus first landed in the Caribbean. There was approximately 18 million people living in America. And all Native Americans. And after about 100 years, there's about 1 million left. So that was one of the largest massacres, really, and decimations of a people, and really a genocide in the history of the world. And so that one fact alone is something that, if we don't really face and own that and heal that, it leaves us prone to repeat it in subtle ways. You know, Germany, I think, has done a really impressive job of facing the history of its own genocide with Hitler and really building that into curriculum and understanding and making amends. And there's a way in which Germany has become a much more mature, sober, generous country as a result of that deep shadow work. Now, if you don't do the deep shadow work, you're prone to just create a more inflated sense of self-importance. And that's one of the shadow sides of America, is that we tend to be too full of ourselves and too grand, and we're number one, and we're not actually meeting other countries on their own terms, or even being that curious about other cultures a lot of times. So I trace some of that back to this founding genocide that we've never really dealt with, and that creates this shadow, because I think that the higher possibility was for the white, primarily European culture to come in and learn from, in a kind of mutual exchange and reciprocity with the native peoples. The native peoples had great wisdom in different spheres, and there's a particular way in which indigenous peoples are very strong in a kind of a tribe a loyalty to the tribe, a kind of decentering from individuality and focusing more on the tribe, and also a deep loyalty to Mother Earth and to the nature and kind of communing with the elements and plants and to actually be in deep, right relationship. And so what's happened is our culture has lacked some of that earthy reverence, and we've ended up being kind of very fiery and more belligerent and sometimes more full of ourselves as a people. And so there was a way in which the native culture could have had a softening, grounding, opening influence on the white culture that was coming in. So there's a Hopi prophecy that this we're now in the time of the restoring of the sacred hoop. And from their perspective, there's four major tribal groupings, if you will, on the planet. The white tribes, the red tribes, the yellow tribes, and the black tribes, just in terms of our skin colors. And each was given stewardship over one element. So the white tribes over fire, the red tribes over earth, the yellow tribes over air, and the black tribes over water. So what happens is if you have a fire culture that isn't balanced by the other two, it can become self-destructive and overly violent and overly combative and aggressive. But if you balance it with the earth element, balance it with the other cultures, you end up with something that's more whole and more holistic. And so part of the reason for the shadow work is not just, to kind of self-flagellate ourselves and we're terrible for being white people and we did all this stuff. It's more like, no, there was a developmental process that we missed out on and our culture needs to go back now and reclaim that. And so part of that, I think, is getting into deeper relationship with indigenous traditions and peoples. We've done quite a number of things at the Shift Network. And I have to say that different indigenous people have been profound teachers to me, and I feel like I've really learned a lot and been humbled and grounded in different ways and learned to relate with the planet in a deeper, more reverential way. So I think that, you know, there's a recognition that each of us, when we're growing up in a culture, we're getting certain strengths, like we're getting a lot of strengths in American culture of our creativity and ingenuity and self-initiative and being even rebellious and kind of doing our own thing. But there's ways in which we don't take as much care of the tribe or of each other or like really Mother Earth. And so we can live in a more destructive way. So if we do this shadow work, it helps us to open to a whole realm of qualities and virtues that our culture didn't get built into the DNA as much as would have been helpful.
That's so true. I want to touch on a couple of more things that you were talking about a few minutes ago, but I think at this point I want to take a quick break, and we are going to be right back in a moment. We are talking with Stephen Dynan about his book, Sacred America, Sacred World. And what is your website, Stephen?
SacredAmerica.net.
SacredAmerica.net, and you can also find that on the website for the radio program. You're listening to Conscious Bridge Radio. This is Mark Gilbert. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Debbie Lynn Molyneux, president of Coffee Party USA. I hope you're enjoying this program, which is part of the Coffee Party's radio network of shows. Have you ever wondered exactly what is the Coffee Party? Well, have you ever brought up the subject of politics and watched as people roll their eyes? Well, Coffee Party is an all-volunteer nonprofit to encourage respectful conversation around politics. We want people to connect with each other in a more meaningful way. Coffee Party supports reforms of our electoral, campaign finance, government accountability, and tax systems. We also promote cultural changes to address political disengagement, polarization, and misinformation. Won't you come join us? Check out our website and find out how you can get involved as a member and a volunteer of Coffee Party USA today. Help bring civility and reason back to our political process. Go to coffeepartyusa.com to find out more. That's coffeepartyusa.com. Thank you.
Hi, Mark Gilbert again. I hope you're enjoying this radio program. I invite you to also check out the Conscious Bridge website at www.consciousbridge.com or see the link on the radio program's website. There, I've been sharing my exploration of the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture for the past 6 years. You'll find descriptions and links of all four of my books, as well as years of articles, free audios, videos, listings and links to numerous resources, and be sure and sign up for my newsletter as well. If you do, you'll get a free gift from me. All of this and a whole lot more at consciousbridge.com. Now back to our program. Welcome back. It's Mark Gilbert again, and we're talking with Stephen Dynan, author of the new book, Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All. Stephen, you were talking a few minutes ago about some of the innovative solutions that you felt like would be critical for us to moving not only to this sacred worldview, to developing our evolutionary viewpoint, but to actually being proactive in moving us to the place where we could actually create this sacred America and sacred world where we see all as sacred. You talk about a number of things: stronger families, educational improvements, creating a culture of peace, ending global warming. You mentioned microfinancing a few minutes ago. And one that I felt was really intriguing was your take on the topic of creating sacred corporations. I was going to ask you, what exactly do you feel a sacred corporation is, and what are some of the steps that could take us from moving to a place where I think many people now feel like corporations have become sort of dysfunctional in some areas, that they've taken to their nth degree, they tend to influence the government for their own betterment, and that it's creating sort of this continuous cycle of corporate control and corporate power, which is leading to income inequality and a host of other things. But the idea of sacred corporations seems very intriguing.
I think, first of all, it's good to just play with the term, because it brings into question a lot of the left-leaning tendencies to just demonize the corporations as the source of the problems for the world. And there's a truth in that critique, because the way a lot of corporations are currently acting, it isn't in the service of the greater good, and it is kind of in a pathological, self-interested way where it can be exploitive and damaging the environment and hurt other people. However, the strategy of saying, okay, well, what we need to do is just destroy corporations or constrain them or do this, that actually goes in the opposite direction. The challenge is, how do you realign the incentives so that the most conscious, sacred, generous corporations win, that they get more of the money, they get more of the resources, they get more of the success? Because there's nothing that's faster at creating change on this planet than capitalism, when it's harnessed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So what I look at is, first of all, you have to kind of shift the bias against companies, because mostly the flow of corporations, the flow of money, these are all things that we've created certain ground rules around how they happen or don't happen, and we can change them. That's part of the whole political process, is that we can change a lot of these structures. So, that we can actually incentivize companies to do the right thing. So one example I give is the idea of a conscious ratings tag. So in the world of food, for a long time, you never knew what was in your food, and eventually we got an ingredients list, including nutritional facts, embedded on everything sold. So what if we were to build into a system where there's that same kind of ratings process for different aspects of corporate social responsibility? So, how workers are treated, impact on the environment, financial, where they invest their money. And there's a clear set of criteria that different companies can be rated on for how beneficial that company is to the greater good. Now, the advantage of doing this in a more granular way, rather than just getting a green sticker or a Energy Star appliance, which is just looking at one variable, is that then you have companies that are competing to shine more as for their social responsibility. And as they do that, then you end up having positive feedback loops from consumers as well, because you can say, I'm only going to buy from companies that have an 8 out of 10 rating on this, 10 different variables related to conscious ratings. Mm-hmm. You can also do the same thing with investment. You could say, I only want to invest in companies that have a 7 out of 10 rating or better. And so you can have mutual funds that only include those. So as soon as you quantify it better, right now we have some social screenings in place, but they tend to be either or binary versus incentivizing continued improvement or even improvement relative to the rest of an industry. So you're harnessing the competitive pressures and the market pressures to make the companies get even better at being socially responsible. So right now, it's like because we are in this new, great new era where we have so much more access to data, this kind of a system wouldn't actually be that hard to implement. There's complexities involved, but it could be for a relatively very small percentage of the overall economy. And it could really make that the full repercussions of each dollar we spent so much more transparent. Because if part of the real challenge right now is that the corporations are actually obeying the consumers in many cases. The consumers are incentivizing things that they don't know about. So if the company is like, I can deliver this product, this new pair of shoes cheaper using child labor in Indonesia, and the consumer doesn't know about it and it doesn't affect the sales, then ultimately the consumer is sort of incentivizing by buying the lower priced shoes to that company to cut some corners. But if it's all transparent and we're saying I'm only going to buy from X, Y, and Z, then it accelerates this process of doing business with the companies that really reflect our values. And I think it can mean that we transition much, much more quickly into a truly conscious capitalistic society. And so the advantage of that is that, you know, that capitalism does create a diversity of options for and a lot of different perspectives on how to serve needs, whereas government only provides one. So there's a strong recognition on the right that capitalism is generally, if you can get the system to align properly, it's going to be more effective at serving people's needs because of the diversity and because of some competitive pressures and because there's innovation all over the place. It's ultimately going to be more effective than the government at really solving issues. Now, that doesn't apply to all issues, and there has to be constraints on the behavior. So you want to set certain constraints on how people can compete. That's where something like a $15 an hour minimum wage comes very in handy, because right now, effectively, what you have is taxpayers are subsidizing companies who are paying less than it takes for their workers to live. Now, I'll say that again. We tend to focus more on like the end user, or $7 an hour McDonald's employee. But in actuality, we're really the taxpayer money that's going to subsidize the childcare and rent and food and other things for a minimum wage employee is actually being not so much in subsidizing that person. It's actually subsidizing the company that is able to hire them and get them to do work for them to generate value without paying them enough to live. Mm-hmm. And so it's a form of corporate welfare to have a lower minimum wage. And so if you set the minimum wage at a level that is really allows people to take care of at least their basic needs, that actually serves everybody, including people on the right who want to minimize the size of government, who don't like the idea of welfare for companies or people, that they don't want to subsidize other people, that they want people to have to stand on their own. So you end up with something that's traditionally been a left-leaning policy, a $15 an hour minimum wage. But if you look at it from a different lens, it actually can be very powerful for advancing right-leaning values and goals as well, and creating the context where the most conscious companies are encouraged to thrive. So you set some basic foundational ground rules, just like we no longer have child labor in the United States. So there's this key principle of making things much more transparent and then aligning the incentives and letting the market forces, once all the incentives are really lined up so that we're not exploiting people, but we're competing on our ability to be creative and generate value. That's when we liberate more and more of the positive potential. So I think it's important to take that stance, because otherwise we're always fighting corporations and trying to negate them. And ultimately there's so many forces that are very strong in place that are going to make that very difficult. So instead of fighting it, trying to suppress it, it's like you're helping corporations evolve to their next level of health and expression. And frankly, that's what most people who work for companies want anyway, because they want to feel good about who they're working for and they want to feel good about the services they're providing.
Yeah, that's so true. And hearkening back to the term you used earlier about the dynamic tension, I believe that what we're really talking about is creating a dynamic tension so that corporations are free to engage in practices that are incentivized towards the better good for people, but they're only going to do that when there's a dynamic tension of consumer demand employee desire to work for a company who's making a difference in the planet, and to some degree, government regulation. You know, that's become sort of a bad term in some libertarians' eyes. They don't like anything dealing with government, but government, in my mind, anything can get out of balance.
Right.
If corporations get out of balance, then we can have a system that's run amok with income inequality and the things that we're seeing now with corporate control of a lot of our government decisions. Whereas if there's too much government, it can get out of control and put too much restrictions on corporations and companies so that they're not going to innovate and create the wealth and prosperity that we want. So I think a lot of times our polarization drives us into these different camps where we take these sort of plant a flag, you know, where we're standing and argue our point and not see that what we really need is both sides working together and creating that tension that's going to, you know, actually create the better world for everybody.
We need healthy government. We don't need bigger government necessarily. We need healthier, more effective, better designed government, and that everybody can be on board with that. We also need healthier, better designed, and better incentivized corporations because they are such a powerful engine. So this is part of where the cross training is really important, because while if we're just in the liberal progressive worldview, we can start to just, it's the water in which we're swimming. And so it's just like anti-corporation this, anti-corporation that. We start to just take it for granted that corporations are bad or evil, rather than, actually there's something about that that's not right. And actually it's not a very good solution to just be anti-something.
Right.
You have to be pro, how does it evolve to the next level? Same thing on the right, where their tendency is more to be anti-government. It actually doesn't help government function better to simply be anti-government, or somebody, I forget who the quote was, that wanted government to be small enough to drown it in a bathtub. You know, that kind of antagonism towards government is not going to lead to really great governance and effective governance, because you're basically denying the intrinsic value in something. And so we've become a little more like gardeners. We're trying to grow something to the next level, whatever that institution is, and not buy into the extreme position that something is just intrinsically bad or wrong and needs to be negated.
Yeah, and that leads me to the point I really liked about you referencing seeing the 99% versus the 1% as polarizing and creating divisions between us, that you call us to see that we're all part of the 100%.
Yeah,
I think that's such a critical point, because a lot of times it's easy for us to say, oh, I'm going to demonize the other side. In this case, many of us live the lives in the 99% and feel like everything is controlled by the 1%. Well, what we don't realize is or tend to forget and not focus upon is that, yes, even though we're going through income inequality right now, we're a part of them and they're a part of us and we're a part of this whole. And together, it's better when we work together. And so if we can find solutions that don't demonize the other, but find a way to actually create the wealth and uplift everybody at the same time.
Amen to that. Yeah, and I think the thing is, it's like from a spiritual perspective, when we're antagonistic towards something, we are reinforcing separation, which means it's going to be very hard to build an effective collaborative bridge there, because there's just a lot of negativity in the space. So let's say that like the billionaire class, the billionaire and centimillionaires, there's a lot of really deeply committed people in there who are dedicating a lot of their wealth and energy to uplifting the world, including in the next generation, their kids and offspring. Meanwhile, if they're feeling venom and hatred spewed at them all the time, they're going to want to wall off more from all the folks who are doing that. So it's really a case of shooting yourself in the foot. This is where I think Bernie Sanders went awry with his campaign, is it while it was galvanizing to really focus around the billionaire class, he ultimately was creating more polarization there than I think really serves, because there are plenty of people who are wealthy who want to see the kind of changes and evolution in the world, but it creates a schism and a sense of class warfare rather than class collaboration to like really grow the society together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have the old saying, what we resist persists, and that's so true. One of the things that you've been doing, and you referenced it a number of items in your book, of the actions of the Shift Network, and I mentioned that in the introduction to you earlier, Stephen, that this is the organization that you created to offer up life transformational classes and Can you tell us a little bit about the Shift Network and what it does, and for people who might not be familiar with it and how they can connect with it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's at theshiftnetwork.com, and we produce about 18 major telesummits and 75 paid programs and various other events and activities right now every year. And they're all really focused on evolving to a new paradigm. So some of that is personal growth oriented and spiritual growth. We have teachers from many different lineages, from Christianity to Hinduism to shamanism to, and then we also have things in holistic medicine and health. So there's a sense that we have of like that we're uplifting the paradigm on all fronts, that we're moving to a new operating system for our world. And so that new operating system requires a new consciousness, like we've talked about, global consciousness. It's holistic and integrative. It also involves dealing with these different areas in different ways. So we've had stuff on parenting. We've had stuff on enlightened business. We do things on shamanism, Enneagram, women's work. We did a men's summit, men's initiation. So we're looking at what's the leading edge of all these different domains where we can take a more integrative, holistic approach to it and really design a better society from that standpoint, whether that's our healthcare and well-being, whether it's psychology, whether it's green business. So we try to create a kind of a broad umbrella so that people who really want to be part of this shift of paradigm have a lot of resources and access to inspiring teachers and programs and certifications that help them go to the next level. So we've done that kind of more as an educational enterprise first, and then we're going to be moving more into multimedia and TV and eventually, you know, films and music, so that we're looking at the things that propagate more easily and like helping to have these different forms of media evolve our consciousness and inspire us with the people who are really creating solutions around the world. I think that's one of the great tasks of our day, is simply to amplify the innovation that's happening all over the place. There's so much that's inspiring that's happening, and it's important that we hear about it, because otherwise we can get more and more closed down listening to the latest massacre on the news or the latest war that's happening. There's a way in which that it's hard to stay as open and optimistic when there's an onslaught of that. So we have to be counterbalanced, and we don't want to shut down and be ignorant of what's happening in the world, but we also want to put our attention and amplify and grow and nurture those things that really are innovations that work. So I talk in the book about solutions councils from the grassroots all the way up to the White House. They could be a parallel structure to government where you basically harvest the innovation, you propagate it to other places, and you amplify it, which is also supported by media. So we basically we're in the evolution business, personal and collective, and we're we do our best to bring the best teachers in the world together and make the programs pretty accessible. So it's, you know, most of our programs are $300 programs. They're not like university level prices. It's more accessible for people who are working and committed to growth.
And I highly recommend your programs. I've taken a few of them myself in the past, and I find that the work that you're doing is outstanding. So to our listeners, I highly encourage you to check it out. See the website link on the radio program's website. Getting back to your book, Stephen, I want to talk about the fact that it really is getting at, once we've developed this sacred worldview, seeing everything is connected, the evolutionary viewpoint, healing our shadow, focusing on innovative solutions to some of our problems that the world faces, a lot of it is getting into this aspect of healing the polarization in politics in the United States.
It's not easy, because this stuff runs deep. You know, I give the example. I don't want to like pretend like I don't have my biases. You know, there are things that when Trump states that it really get on my nerves, and I can react and be judgmental there. And there's some genuine discernment in that, but I think it's important that whatever our political persuasion is, that we really learn to open to and see what can we value, what can we honor in the other. I did this for instance, with Sarah Palin when she was the vice presidential candidate. She was like nails on a chalkboard for me, and I forced myself to read both of her books. And it actually really shifted my dynamic with her, and really felt like I could see where the source of her value system and her perspective, and honor some of the qualities that before I found really grating. And I felt like, and I ended up having a dream where we kind of had a nice hug in the dream, and it was just sort of very cordial and friendly. And so it's not even like, in a way, political leaders become symbolic of aspects of reality that we don't like. And so if we really want to take our spiritual practice to the next level, try to find a place in our heart for even those people that symbolize aspects of reality that we're not as fond of. And so it becomes, as we do that, then we're able to speak to those people who also support that person as a leader and see them as a champion of their values. Because otherwise, we haven't really earned the right to have a deeper relationship, because we're busy judging, marginalizing, diminishing who they see as a very worthy leader.
That is so true. I think one of the other things I think that I know that I've recommended it on my website, and I believe you also had this in your book, was the fact that we can sometimes take ourselves and stay in a comfort zone of only getting our news and information from those comfortable sources that say what we want to hear. And I think one of those other areas that really that we need to take a look at is pressing ourselves to look at the positions of the other sides and consider them. Don't just look at them from a standpoint of being angry about them and dismissing them, but also looking at them and saying, well, okay, what's of value here? What is it, the need that is trying to be met by this position, and how can I see where this might be serving our greater growth to take something from this?
That's where real innovation happens. It comes out of diversity, not out of just a monoculture. That's where something where the left-leaning progressives can understand. It's like, we don't like monocultures in agriculture because there's a lack of the full diversity. But when you have a diversity of ingredients, you can often get something that's stronger and more resilient. So when we take the time to actually read and think about other positions that might be distasteful, I just ordered a book called Liberal Fascism. And, you know, I was a little like, oh, I can't believe I'm ordering this. But I read the first 15 or 20 pages, and it really shifted some things in my psychology and made me aware of patterns on the left that I hadn't been aware of and some of the problematic aspects. But it took like actually entering into the whole world of somebody that thought very differently. And I think that ultimately that strengthens us, because we're going to be able to speak to a wider range of people and offer deeper solutions that really embrace the needs of more people than just kind of, you know, trotting out the same old tried and true and just trying to shove it down somebody's throat.
I can see now, Stephen, I'm going to have to go read The Art of the Deal after this.
You know, I think you're pointing out, I probably have to do that myself.
And speaking of Trump, what are your thoughts on the current political climate and candidates for president this year and the way first woman nominee from a major party?
I'm very excited about the prospect for a Hillary, you know, first, I mean, Hillary in particular. I think she's extremely well qualified. I know there's a lot of critiques of her. I think there are some legitimate critiques, but I think they get overplayed. I think she has a lot of deep skill and a real commitment to serving the needs of all and really, you know, working with people. I feel good about supporting her. I was very supportive of Bernie being in the race. I gave him some money and was very excited about him just being a voice for holding out that the highest possibility, what's possible, and shifting the political discourse into what's possible as a country. And I think he illuminated some things that have been kind of un-American to even think about that I think are really valuable positions to consider. In terms of Trump, I think he's more of a stretch for me. There were definitely other Republican candidates that I could have gotten on board with a lot more. And I think Trump, the redemptive possibility of Trump, I think, is that he, by making everything explicit, by not making it code or covert, he's illuminating some of the more regressive aspects on the right that hopefully will force a longer-term maturation, that it, instead of just being underground, that it will lead to a maturation of the party. I think that this year will be the opportunity for the Republican Party to go to its next level of expression. And I go into this in the book that we don't just need progressives to win or Democrats to win. We need an evolution of both political parties to the next level of maturity, depth, and wisdom. And so we need a more enlightened Republican Party just as much as we need a more enlightened Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that some of the tectonics and the fissures and the challenges and the all of what Trump is stirring up
ultimately helps the Republican Party become a more shining, better example of the values that it wants to see in the world. So I'm hopeful for that. Well, I'm also, you know, I'm definitely a backer of Hillary and hopeful that Trump does not actually end up in the White House.
Although, you know, I share your feelings on that. I think one of the things that we as Americans need to take a look at is the reason that our country gave rise to a Trump. What are the needs of people who right. have such a frustration with our system and a frustration here having their voices heard that they would back a candidate that for many of us seems an unreasonable choice?
There was somebody who did a sociological study, went to Louisiana and really interviewed Trump supporters who were in the bayou and small towns and really just stepped back in a very neutral way and looked at what are the values and try to language this from their own perspective. And mm-hmm. and really, there's a lot of people who feel like things they've gotten left behind in one way or the other, and that their voices aren't being heard. And so they've been backing somebody who it feels like the strong man who's going to fight for them. And I think that's ultimately where the illusion is, because I think that Trump is playing into that, but I don't think he was really delivering on that. But the genuine need underneath to have everyone have a voice and have everybody's needs for economic and personal growth and development to be honored. There's a way in which on the liberal left is like it's gotten too in the ivory towers and not necessarily really listening to some of the people and the hardship in the smaller towns and the kind of white working class. That mm-hmm. it's a way it's gotten too identified with minorities and with women and with there's a way in which sometimes it's gotten over-identified in the service of championing certain voices that have been marginalized. And in the meantime, doesn't feel like it's really listening to or honoring the needs of some other people. And a lot of those people are finding a champion in Trump. And I think what you're pointing to is right. It's like that's part of why it's important to do our own inner work on the leaders and reacting to leaders, because if we react to the leaders and attack the leaders, then chances are we're going to lose an opportunity to really meet and engage with the people who follow that leader as to why they're following that leader. And so that's really important. So I feel like this year is not just about, who wins Hillary versus Trump. It's also about how can we use this as an opportunity to come together as one united people rather than to be further torn apart.
Absolutely. I think once you start putting on that evolutionary lens as well, you start seeing that everything that happens for some purpose. And we can either ignore that purpose and bury it and have to deal with it later, or we can delve into it and ask the tough questions that make us grow as both as a person in our individual lives, but collectively as the United States and in our shifting to even a more world-centric viewpoint in the future. You come to a conclusion on your book talking about the World Campaign 2020. What is this for you, and how do you see it playing out, and what are the pieces of it, and how can people get involved?
Well, it's at a fairly early stage of development now, but basically it's a vision to use 2020, which is a particularly appropriate date for seeing more clearly. 2020 vision is all about seeing clearly. So it's about activating a vision of higher potential for our world and to have a real coming together. So there's a number of us who came to similar conclusions that 2020 offers an opportunity for this reset of the global vision of who we are and what we're capable of. And so on September 21st, 2020, to use the International Day of Peace as a real global, a point of global unification, and to have celebratory events and music concerts, but also commitments to working together and a kind of activation of visions for potential for each country. When I spoke in China a number of years ago, I talked about China activating a 2050 vision. What is China's contribution to the larger shift of our world? And so there's something about decade markers, and particularly 2020, and thinking about how do we, by the middle point of this century, have really turned things around on the planet so that we are living peacefully, sustainably, healthy, and prosperous way versus the kind of more nightmare scenarios which could play out as well. So
you know, we're the easiest thing right now is just to get on the Shift Network list at theshiftnetwork.com, and we'll be rolling that out over time. Frankly, with the launch of the book and everything else this year, I haven't had time to do as much on that, but it's like laid down some tracks for how do we unify more change movements and try to make as much positive change happen by 2020, and then use this September 21st as a global coming together, a reset of the vision, and then also people who participate in that then would get access to a whole curriculum of personal empowerment as well. So it's a bit of a longer term vision at this point, but we've got some years to develop. So it kind of provides a nice focalizing energy for Shift and for those who are want to partner with us.
And the seed is planted by your upcoming book, Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All. We've been talking with author Stephen Dynan about this upcoming book. It's a great read. I encourage all of our listeners to get a copy of it. And Stephen, it's coming out July 5th, Interdependence Day. And you're going to be having some promotions about this. How can people find out more and get involved in some of the freebies and things you're going to be giving out as part of?
Okay. Just the week of the launch, go to sacredamerica.net. We'll have links to the whole campaign. It'll have a lot of extra goodies in for anybody who purchases the book that week. So we want to, or in that particular day, actually. So we're going to have it on July 5th. So just go there on July 5th and you get all the details you need.
So mark your calendars and July 5th and pick up a copy of Sacred America, Sacred World. I guarantee you will not be disappointed by it. Any closing words that you'd like to leave with our listeners today, Stephen? Anything I didn't ask you about that you wanted to make sure you get out there?
No, I just feel like, you know, clearly you're attracting a very conscious audience. So just for all of us to bring together the best of what we know from our personal growth and spiritual practices and to really act as unifying forces within our society so that we can help to, you know, restore, to bring the American family back together and go to the next level, because we have a high and noble destiny for our country, and it's going to take a lot of people working together to make it happen.
Yes, we can be that true shining light on the hill, shining city on the hill. Thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us today. Again, we've been talking with Stephen Dynan, the author of Sacred America, Sacred World. We encourage you to get his book. Check out the website for the radio program to find links to the Shift Network as well as Stephen's book. Thank you again for being with us today, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Mark. Really thoughtful interview. Really great connecting with you. And thank you so much for your work with the Coffee Party, too. It's a great organization.
Yes, it really is, and I appreciate it. So to all of you out there listening, thanks for being with us today, and we'll join us next time for our next installment of Conscious Bridge Radio. Till then, take care.